United General Insurance Company versus the Honorable Neil Caldwell. We'll hear argument from the relator.
May it please the court, the relator will be represented by Arthur Glover and Jack McKinley. Mr. Glover will open.
Excuse me, Mr. McKinley. May it please the court, I am Jack McKinley. Co-counsel is Arthur Glover, also representing United General Insurance Company. Seated behind us is Mike Phillips, who is the counsel for the employer of the decedent in this case, that is Schaefer Well Service. He has filed an affidavit, which the court should have in its record, but he is not arguing today because he did not file the petition for writ of mandamus. That is entirely United General's. In presenting our argument, I'd like to speak for 20 or 25 minutes and give the court an opportunity for questions if it has not already interrupted me. I think I should start by focusing on the facts of the case to the extent that the court is not already familiar with them. The allegation is that Judy Zimmerman's husband, Russell, died because of the gross negligence of his employer, Schaefer Well Service, and also because of the negligence of some other defendants, one of whom appears to have recently settled with the plaintiffs. The allegation is further that representatives of Schaefer Well Service and United General Insurance Company on two different occasions, separately or together, went out to visit plaintiffs to offer condolences and to tell her initially that there just wasn't a case to be made against Schaefer Well Service. The theory of the plaintiffs is that the representations made by the then counsel for United General, who I believe was a house counsel, and the representatives of Schaefer Well Service caused the plaintiff to abandon plans which she otherwise might have undertaken to pursue her statutorily permitted death action against her husband's employer on a gross negligence theory. She did not pursue it initially. She turned it over to an attorney, Ronald Crist, in her own area, who, after discussions with a representative of Schaefer Well Service and perhaps United General, not Mr. Phillips, but an attorney directly employed by United General, Mr. Crist decided that the action was not worth pursuing, and he just didn't want to pursue it. She later gave the case to a local attorney, George Taylor, who referred the case to Harville and Hardy, who now have the case, and who have additionally retained Mr. Kronzer to assist them in arguing to this court and to the court below. The theory on which the plaintiff seeks to make her case against United General is that in some way its representation to the plaintiff caused her to abandon a cause of action which she could state under the law, that United General tried to convince her she didn't have a cause of action, and then afterwards tried to come back and enlist her to go after other defendants so that when a verdict might finally be rendered, giving plaintiffs some damages, it would be against other defendants, and United General would, through its compensation intervention, recover money from those other defendants while not having to pay anything out. Now, plaintiff hasn't lost a cause of action. Plaintiff has suffered, as deposition testimony in the record indicates, a very small delay in initiating a cause of action, and from the moment she's initiated the cause of action, it has always been for what she is now suing for, although it's been stated differently in some amended petitions. The only possible delay, the only possible damage that plaintiff could assert, some damage due to the delay in Harville and Hardy picking up this suit and proceeding with discovery. We sought to have this court let us take the depositions of opposing counsel, and we sought something else which the court has decided we won't consider, and we're here today only on the question of severance. It is our position that the Honorable Neil Caldwell abused his discretion when he overruled the attempts of both Schaefer Well Service, the decedent's employer, and my client, United Insurance Company, to sever the wrongful death cause of action against the two defendants, Amrata Hess and Central Power and Light, and the plaintiff's employer, another defendant, from the cause of action very vaguely stated for insurance fraud, overreaching, and unfair practices against United General. It is our position that the causes of action are utterly distinct. They don't relate to the same proof. They will require completely different theories. They will require completely different arguments. And much of the testimony which can be heard in one case cannot be heard in the other case. First of all, I'd like to talk about a test for an abuse of discretion, because that's what we're here today about. We're contending that Judge Caldwell abused his discretion, or alternatively, as this court has once phrased it, failed to exercise any discretion, because there just couldn't be any ruling made by a reasonable judge other than the ruling that we're asking for. I believe that the test is, first of all, the discretion was abused, or it wasn't exercised at all. This court had ruled in Womack versus Berry, State Bar versus Heard, and a multitude of other cases, some of which I will mention, that it is possible to impose mandamus against a judge if he has abused his discretion or failed to exercise it. In the Womack versus Berry case, this court held in 1956 that a severance could be ordered through mandamus when the judge abused his discretion in failing to order the severance. This court held that the rule denying mandamus for matters of discretionary character is not without limitation, and mandamus can issue in a proper case. The court went on to say, when all the facts and circumstances of the case unquestionably require a separate trial to prevent manifest injustice, and there is no fact or circumstance supporting or tending to support a contrary conclusion, and the legal rights of the parties will not be prejudiced thereby, there is no room for the exercise of discretion. The Attorney General's position that there was no room for the exercise of discretion in this case, given the record before Judge Caldwell, which I think the parties are not in dispute about, he should have and must order this case severed, that is, one cause of action from another. Other cases in which this court has ruled that mandamus will issue to correct pretrial abuses of discretion include Rodriguez versus Travis Life Insurance Company concerning tax returns, West versus Salido in 1978 concerning attorney-client privilege and production of documents which theoretically couldn't be produced because of that, State Bar of Texas versus Heard, which concerned disbarment and license suspension, Allen versus Humphreys, a landmark case which concerned the production of documents against the claim that they were irrelevant or privileged, and State versus Thurman, a criminal case, and Barker versus Dunham concerning the depositions of experts and their materials. It is important to note that in all of those cases, the court found that there was substantial harm to the person requesting that a particular act be performed when the act wasn't performed. But contrary to what the respondents are saying in this case, the courts didn't apply harmless error rule. This very court, for two decades or more, has not even thought about applying a harmless error rule in the context of pretrial discovery rulings by a trial judge. The ruling from this court has always been either the judge did not abuse his discretion or he did, the petitioner or the relator was substantially harmed or he wasn't, and there is or is not an adequate remedy at law. In not one of these cases ruled on by this court has the court ever suggested you who want tax returns or say that your tax returns can't be produced, you can wait until the end of the trial and see if that inflammatory information, which shouldn't have been given up, tended to cause and probably did cause the rendition of an improper verdict. Or you who want documents and think you have the right to take a deposition of an expert, we don't know what effect that's going to have on the trial, so let's just wait. After we've gone through a 3 or 4 week trial, then the appellate court can look at the whole record and decide if it tended to cause and probably did cause the rendition of an improper verdict. This court has never used that test for an obvious reason. It wouldn't be sensible. The harmless error rule was conceived to deal with in-trial rulings by a judge who's facing what we might call a sudden emergency in another context. An attorney stands up and blurts out the word insurance. Something else happens that the judge has to make a snap decision about, or at least he doesn't have time to peruse the case law over a period of days. In those cases, the harmless error rule applies, as it should, because that's the situation it was conceived to deal with. In the pretrial context, in which the judge has all the time in the world to make the right decision, it is so important that he see the ruling of this court that he has to make the right decision. And if he doesn't know the law, he's got to go look for the law. And if there's any question about what the ruling is, he needs to do everything he can to satisfy himself that he's right. He can't just say, well, I think that's discretionary and I'm not going to do it. If he's going to make that statement, he better be right. And I don't think the harmless error rule is the test that governs the determination whether or not that judge is right. Now, it is also required that there be substantial harm, that there be prejudice to a litigant if he doesn't get what he's asking for. That is put another way when the courts have said that you must do justice. Mandamus is in part an equitable proceeding, and this court has considered equity before in ruling on mandamus-related issues. In this particular case, we see two causes of action which are totally dissimilar. We have a wrongful death cause of action stated against three defendants, now two with the settlement. On the other hand, we have what I hadn't seen before until I confronted another case, which is now before this court from the 14th District, and that is a cause of action for insurance fraud, overreaching, and just generally unfair dealing. You think that the insurance company did something really rotten, but you can't put your finger on it, and you're not quite sure what your damages are, but you sue because you have a duty to your client, and you want to see if there is a cause of action. I can't talk to this court about what its ruling will be on that case, which I believe is the Massey case, now on appeal from the 14th District in Houston. The court knows better than I, but the 14th District ruled that the cause of action doesn't exist. We've been criticized as attorneys for United General. We've been criticized by the respondents for not going ahead and trying to simply eliminate the cause of action. We should have filed for summary judgment. We should have done something else. Instead, we chose to file a motion for severance. That's our right. It's within our discretion to proceed with the lawsuit how we want to proceed. If this court upholds the ruling of the 14th District, obviously our next step is to file a motion for summary judgment or a motion for or special exception saying the cause of action doesn't exist. But we had a right to go before the court and ask the court to sever. The court refused to do that. Consider the harm. The very first day of trial, the jury is going to be impaneled. On voir dire, the plaintiff's attorneys are going to be talking about insurance immediately. They're going to be talking about the fact, they say, that attorneys and agents representing United General and Schaefer Well Service came out to this widow's home where she was with her child. They tried to take advantage of her. They tried to tell her she didn't have a good cause of action against her husband's employer. They later got in touch with her, and they tried to convince her to let them file a cause of action, which they would completely take care of against the other two defendants, all the while not letting her know that they were going to be writing off the intervention that they would have filed for the Workers' Compensation Act. Now, much of the reply briefs filed by the respondents in this case is devoted to their cause of action, whether or not the cause of action exists, and I can understand why. They know that if this court rules unfavorably to them in the Massey case, that is, makes a ruling that indicates their cause of action is worthless, we're not going to be back here arguing about that cause of action because Judge Caldwell will have to give us a summary judgment. So right now, while they've got the chance, they want to talk to this court about why this court should rule that the cause of action really exists. I'm not going to talk about that because that's not what we're here about. I'd just like to talk about the unfair situation in which United General and Schaefer Well Service will find themselves at the time of trial if what Judge Caldwell has ruled is allowed to go through. The attorneys will be speaking to the jury and encouraging the jury to find liability against United General on a theory which may or may not be tenable. It may be that at the close of the evidence, the court will give us an instructed verdict, but what will have happened? All throughout the trial, the jury will have heard that representatives of United General, first of all, insured Schaefer Well Service. Insurance is in the case. The jury knows that insurance is in the case. The decisions of this court and all other courts of this state indicate the commonsensical trial lawyer's knowledge that when the jury knows there's insurance, it's first of all more likely to render a verdict for the plaintiff, and it's second of all more likely to award more money. That was pointed out by the court in Kirby Petroleum, the Jones case, which was not the basis for the holding. It was just an observation, and it's an observation that I think few trial lawyers will deny. Secondly, the jury is going to know, beyond the fact that insurance is in the case and that United General insured Schaefer Well Service, all these horrible things which United General's representatives supposedly did. Now, the lawyers representing United General and the lawyers representing Schaefer in the time of trial won't have been the ones who did these things, but that's not going to stop the jury from holding it against United General and Schaefer. The jury will do what, under normal circumstances, it could never do. This is an ideal situation for the plaintiffs. The judge may give limiting instructions. We don't know what the import of those will be, and we certainly don't know if the jury will follow them. Of course, the rulings of the courts of this state are that you can't presume the jury will ignore limiting instructions. But consider how much of the judge's statements is going to be in the record. The judge is going to talk more than anyone, including the lawyers and including maybe the plaintiff. The judge is constantly going to be having to say, now, ladies and gentlemen, when this witness talks about how horrible United General is and what he's done, or what it has done through its agents, and the fact that there is insurance, and the fact that the insurance company did this, you can't hold that against Schaefer Well Service. Don't even consider it against Schaefer Well Service. There are going to be many, many witnesses, and many aspects of their testimony, and the court is going to have to be repeatedly making that statement to the jury. The jury may or may not understand. I think at a certain point, this court has to take notice of the fact that a jury just can't integrate that kind of statement if it's made repeatedly through a trial. I question whether a judge or a lawyer listening to the evidence in a case like this could possibly sort out the evidence that will be admissible against one defendant from the evidence that will be admissible against another defendant. So then the jury hears the case that the plaintiffs are making for wrongful death against Schaefer Well Service. And the court has to say, in considering the evidence against Schaefer Well Service, don't consider that they have insurance. Just ignore that. Ignore further the fact that their insurance company went out and, according to the plaintiff's evidence, attempted to defraud this widow and her children. Ignore further the fact that Schaefer Well Service may have known about that. Ignore all the attempts that United General may have made to dissuade this woman from suing Schaefer and then later to join with United General in pursuing an action against two other defendants who are also in the case. And then the judge will have to talk in view of what those attorneys say about the effect of the evidence on those two defendants. There is no way that prejudice won't result from that. I suggest that even if the harmless error rule were applied, which it shouldn't be, because this doesn't pertain to an in-trial ruling, even if it were applied, you couldn't sort out the admissible from the inadmissible, and you couldn't determine in the event the jury comes back with a bad verdict, that is, a verdict that says United General and Schaefer Well Service will pay $5 million plus $10 million punitive to Judy Zimmerman, you couldn't sort out the factors that influenced that jury's decision. There would be no way. There would be reams of testimony, and there would be pages and pages of statements by the judge on the record, and this court couldn't even begin to digest that, much less to say this judgment was more probably based on permissible evidence than the jury's consideration of this volume of evidence it was told not to consider. At a certain point, this court has to make a policy decision that you just got to draw a line somewhere.
Yeah, well, your argument seems to me that it would be an excellent argument if you were up here on a point of error. But this is a mundane thing. And it seems that your argument is saying to me that there is a remedy by appeal.
Your Honor, I'm saying that, first of all, there isn't a remedy by appeal because the test is different. If we go to the trial and we appeal, there's only one test that the court's going to consider, I think, and that's the harmless error test. Well, that does us an injustice because this court has never applied the harmless error test to this kind of situation before. It's always applied an abuse of discretion test. And
are you presuming that the ruling by this court would be erroneous if it ever got up here on that point?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that I don't think you could sort out the evidence. In a case like this that's going to last for as long as it will, I think the judge's statements alone to the jury could be that thick. Don't consider this. Do consider this. They'll be wrangling in front of the jury. I think this court, of course, can't throw up its hands and say, we don't know. Take it back. But I don't know what this court would do if it sat around with a stack of records that high and had to decide what limiting instructions were and were not effective. There's no way, I think, that we could show that the evidence admitted and supposed to not be considered by the jury against one defendant but not another was actually the cause of an adverse verdict. I don't think we could show that. I think we would end up losing on appeal, necessarily. If this case were to go to an appeal after a trial because this court refused to apply the abuse of discretion test. And in that same vein, I'd point out that there is a case on point with that which is controlling, and that is the Jones versus Kirby Petroleum case, which is much maligned by the other side. Now, in the Kirby case, The court, which was not this court, but the Court of Civil Appeals in Tyler, ruling in 1964, said that the measure of damages in the appellee's compensation suit and the measure of damages in the appellee's damage suit are entirely different from each other and depend in a great measure on different facts. That was a case in which there was a workers' comp suit, there was a third-party liability suit. These facts weren't even as flagrant and inflammatory as the facts we have in our case, where insurance is injected in the case not just as existing, but as the insurance company being an ogre and a manipulator and a deceiver of widows. The court went on to say, in this case, in Kirby, that to hold that a suit against a comp carrier for workers' comp insurance and a suit against the employer for damages can be tried at the same time would be to ignore the simple facts of the case. It would require the court throughout the trial to instruct the jury that certain portions of the evidence were admissible as against one defendant, while at the same time the same evidence was not admissible against the other defendant. Now this, admittedly, is a case in which the harmless error rule is being applied after a trial decision. But I cite the case not because I suggest the harmless error rule should be applied. I cite the case to indicate this court's emphasis, which has been seen in the courts of this state throughout the decades, that you just can't separate inadmissible from admissible evidence against different defendants at some point. Now, the respondents say that Kirby is not authority. They say, first of all, that Kirby doesn't even apply the right rule. It doesn't apply the harmless error rule. Kirby applies a presumed harm rule. If insurance is in the case, there was an error, let's send it back. Mr. Conzer argued the case, and he lost. Naturally, he's disappointed. I think that we should read the letter of the ruling, read what the judge has said as opposed to Mr. Conzer's characterization of it. And what the court said on page 615, the second paragraph, was, it will be noted, distinguishing some cases, that in each of these cases the point involved was not passed upon and that the employer was exonerated and was not in either of those cases a party before the appellate court and therefore made no complaint, and the error, if any, as against the compensation carrier was harmless. The Texas rules of civil procedure had been changed. The Tyler court wasn't incompetent. It knew that. It applied the harmless error rule. Mr. Conzer is concerned because elsewhere in the opinion the court says, and this is a comment on the evidence, such evidence would, in our opinion, be wholly inadmissible and prejudicial against the employer, that is insurance evidence, while to say that an instruction could erase the prejudicial effect of such testimony on the minds of the jury would be entirely unrealistic. The court was giving its opinion that, in fact, you couldn't erase the impact of it on the minds of the jury, but that wasn't the basis for the decision. The basis for the decision was clearly set out, and the first basis was that the judge had to sever those two causes of action. That they simply couldn't be tried that way.
Going, Kenley, are you asking to be severed out from Amaretta Hess and Central Power and Light? Are you also asking that Schaefer Wells Service be severed out?
Your Honor, we're asking that the cause of action against United General be severed from all the other causes of action.
From the other three defendants.
Right. They have a right to maintain their wrongful death cause of action for gross negligence against the employer. And in that regard, I'd point out something further. This is not just a negligence case. This is a case in which the plaintiffs are going to be trying to make the argument, and they're going to be making the argument, putting on evidence to support it, that the plaintiff's employer was grossly negligent. So they get the jury mad at the plaintiff's employer, at Schaefer Well Service. All that evidence will be coming into the jury's mind, and it'll be staying there. The judge will say, don't consider this gross negligence evidence against United General Insurance Company, because all it did was insure. But what does the jury know? The jury knows that if it renders a judgment against this grossly negligent employer for very high damages, because the employer did something wrong, United General is going to pay. So they up the damages. All the evidence in the case, which might not support, if they were tried independently, a verdict for the plaintiffs against United General or a verdict for the plaintiffs on the gross negligence theory, will be combined in the jury's mind. The jury may be told that it can't ignore it, that it must ignore it. But taken together, as it will in the minds of the jury, that evidence is going to be this high. It's not going to be two separate stacks. And the result will be, because of the enormous complexity of the case and because of the fact that fully half the evidence will be inadmissible against some defendants and fully half will be inadmissible against the other defendants, the plaintiffs will be able to make a case and probably get a verdict in this case, not only against the third-party liability defendants and the employer, but against United General. And they would never be able to do that, I think, based on the evidence that the court has in its record, if these cases were severed. They might make their third-party case. We don't know that. But they couldn't make a case against United General. And if we then go to appeal and we have the harmless error rule, that's our harm. A rule is being applied to us and almost necessarily will result in the verdict for the plaintiffs being affirmed when the correct rule is an abuse of discretion test. Now, I realize I'm in an unusual position telling this court that the abuse of discretion test is a more lenient test than the harmless error rule. But under the facts of this case, I think it is. I think that explains why an appeal is inadequate under the circumstances. The respondent's brief has made many points, some of which I think the court will look at and see are clearly incorrect. Some cases have been mischaracterized. I'd like to refer to just two of the cases. Southern Casualty Company versus Freeman, a Commission of Appeals case in 1930, concerned a suit against an employer and against an insurance company in the alternative. The plaintiff didn't know if it was covered by comp or if it was a third-party case. Under those circumstances, the court said, yes, you can join them. That was 1930. In Hartford Accident and Indemnity Company versus Christensen, the same sort of situation happened. The plaintiff didn't know if he was going to be an independent contractor or if he was going to be covered by comp. He didn't know if he had a third-party liability action or a common law action, rather, or if he had a workers' comp action. The court in Jones versus Kirby Petroleum distinguished those cases, and I think the distinction was correct and accurate. With the little time I have remaining, I'd like to address some of the other points that are made by the respondents in their brief. They suggest that United General has foregone other adequate remedies in the case. And as an example of that, they offer some holdings which I don't think are in point. The Pat Walker and Company versus Johnson case recently decided by this court, which concerned court reporter fees. There wasn't even a trial in that case. There wasn't going to be a trial if the court ruled unfavorably for the simple reason that the appeal would be dead. After the court ruled that the motion to extend time should be denied, that would have been the end of the case. So it's completely distinguishable from this case in which Judge Caldwell's ruling, whatever it is to be, is going to be followed by a trial. The other case cited by the plaintiffs, by the respondents, is Cobb versus Harrington, which they don't bother to go into, but which also doesn't have circumstances remotely similar to the ones that we have in this case. One of the main arguments that the respondents are relying on is that there is no prejudice from having insurance injected into the suit because the holdings of this court and other courts indicate that merely injecting insurance into a suit doesn't create error. Now, that's true. But what cases do they offer? They offer cases in which someone is a witness and he's required to say who he works for. He's required to say, well, yeah, the insurance company employs me. Obviously, a man has to say that under the law of this state in order to show his prejudice. The respondents offer no cases on point to suggest that the injection of insurance into the case under circumstances like the circumstances we face here is permissible. The respondents also suggest that there are common questions of law and fact in these two causes of action. I think if the court looks at the Third Amendment petition, you'll see nothing could be further from the truth. The proof of the insurance fraud action, however it's stated, is going to require the testimony of the plaintiff about totally different circumstances from the circumstances which surround the death. The death occurred, that's the wrongful death cause of action, and much, much later, in a totally different time frame, involving totally different people, involving totally different classes of torts, negligence as opposed to this quasi-tort theory, the cause of action against United General arose if it exists. They didn't rise at the same time, they don't concern the same things, totally different facts will be required to present them and prove them. And the jury will constantly have to be instructed that in making that kind of presentation, the plaintiffs are not offering evidence against one defendant. They're just offering it against another defendant. I don't think the jury can be expected to sort that out, and I don't think the rulings of this court in decreeing that abuse of discretion will be found in pretrial proceedings require that we, United General, wait for a trial. We are in the same position as the people were in the Womack versus Berry case when this court, that a judge, through mandamus, would sever a cause of action from another cause of action Because the judge had abused his discretion in refusing to do that, the court didn't talk at all about the harmless error rule, and I think that is the crux of the argument stated by respondents. I'd like to point out that there's another case now before this court, the St. Paul Insurance Company versus McPeak case, also from Judge Caldwell, in which he indicates that he rules consistently because he did the same thing to someone else, and we would argue that that as well is error. The judge ruled, and the 14th Court of Appeals in Houston quashed him in his ruling by saying that the trial court overruled appellant's timely motion to sever the workers' compensation claim from the claims under Article 21.21, the insurance code, for unfair practices in the business of insurance, bad faith, and gross negligence. Upon reflection, we believe that severance should have been granted. That's what we say. Thank you for your
time. That case, that was on a direct on an appeal.
Pardon me, Your Honor. I didn't investigate this independently. I was told by the 14th Court that it is now before you. If that's wrong, I didn't mean to misstate.
Well, the point is, it wasn't before the Court of Civil Appeals, the Court of Appeals on a mandamus.
No, it was not, Your Honor. It was. It was an appeal, I believe.
Yes, it was an appeal.
Thank you.
So I understand you to say that none of the relief that you seek today can be obtained on appeal. Is that your position?
I believe that we would not get the relief we seek if we appealed the case, because on appeal, the court would apply the harmless error test, and we would very likely lose.
And you believe that there's a difference between the abuse of discretion test and the harmless error test?
Based on the rulings of this court, I did.
In other words, the posture in which the case reaches us would produce the same question, but produce different results.
It has, Your Honor, because this court has never inquired into harmless error when it's ruled on pretrial.
Does that mean you say we're being inconsistent? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I'm saying that this court, whether it does or not, and whether these justices did it or not, has two different kinds of tests. And one depends on whether it's before trial, the other depends on whether it's during trial. And the rule itself says during trial. And that's a rule.
We have different tests for those situations, shouldn't we?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not complaining about it. I'm asking you to apply for our benefit.
It's going to be unfair before trial. It's going to be unfair after trial.
Well, Your Honor, there are different tests between trial and appeal, and I'm not going to say that's wrong. I'm arguing based on the rules this court has enunciated.
Somehow I get the notion that what this argument is that if the trial judge makes a really serious mistake,
an abuse of discretion,
you can come directly to the Supreme Court on mandamus.
That's what we've done, Your Honor.
And that notwithstanding the fact that there is an avenue, the usual avenue, to correct those, that if the judge really makes a mistake, then you can shortcut all of the appellate procedure?
In Humphreys v. Allen, in Barker v. Dunham, in all of those cases, all those lawyers could have said, well, the judge is wrong, but we'll just wait for appeal. They didn't. They asked for mandamus and they got it. That's what we're doing. And we think it's a serious mistake, an abuse of discretion.
Thank you, counsel.
You're fine before the court says you.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the Court of Civil Appeals has jurisdiction. My research suggested it only had to consider mandamus proceedings to protect its own jurisdiction. And I didn't interpret this as a proceeding that protected the Court of Appeals jurisdiction. And I found no Court of Appeals opinions at all other than dealing with jurisdictional questions, so I came to this court.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. James Cronker will open for response.
May it please the court, Mr. McKinney, Mr. Glover, my client, co-counsel, and the young stripling lawyer. I would like to borrow a page from Dean Keaton. There's very little that the petitioner said with which I agree. It has not been my purpose in these briefs to suggest that the mandamus power is proscribed or limited by the harmless error rule as such. I did not mean to say that, and if I have said that, I now withdraw it on this record.
what I have said that this court has consistently said, that if there is an adequate remedy on appeal, it will deign and not use its power because of the obvious dangers of interceding where there is an adequate remedy. Now, so there be no mistake about that, the most recent occasion in which you announced that was in the Pat Walker versus Johnson case. In that case, the question arose as to whether or not there was an abuse of discretion by the Court of Appeals in refusing to receive a statement of facts under Rule 21C, or pre-existing, because there had been a reasonable explanation. And the precise issue for determination was whether there was an abuse of discretion. The party seeking to order the filing mandamus this court. And in the course of it, now I know the court doesn't like to read, have excerpts read to them, and I don't like to do it, but in all events, the court made it extremely clear and said it in exactly those terms, that in dealing with whether an abuse of discretion exists, that is a matter reviewable by appeal. It is an adequate remedy, and we shouldn't be using our mandamus power to do it, and you said it in spades in the Walker case. Now, going to Womack versus Berry. First, Womack versus Berry is a 174B, a separation of issues as distinguished from a complete severance. That's for open. It's an extremely complicated case in which three young folks were beneficiaries of a testamentary trust, and in which one of those beneficiaries had become of age, 21, and the trust vested as to him. And he received one of greetings, "You are welcomed into the United States Navy." And there was a plea under the Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act. I can remember those days. There's not many people in this room that can, but when you could receive one of those, and the act provided the stayed procedure. And the district judge stayed the whole ball of wax for the minors, the accounting between the banks and the trusts and everything involved. The proof in the case showed that as to the minority interest, the vesting interest, there was no continuing economic interest, and the effect of the application of the stay order in that instance would have been just to deny many of the claims of relief that could have been determined without any involvement of this boy in the services case. This court did not approve a total severance. It approved merely the separation of all of those issues in which he had no interest whatsoever. And expressly said they wouldn't have done that in these words, but for the fact there was no adequate remedy or appeal for the inordinate delay of 4 years, which was the time that the boy projected military service would be. And I'd like to move very quickly to the problem of, and sometimes I'm sure it must seem to this court that you have lodged yourself into a Serbonian bog when you start worrying about the number of mandamuses that come to you in the discovery area. Because it has been an attempt to untie the knot. And I've been both a victim and a user, and I'm aware of it. But what you are doing is preventing, when you permit the enforcement and use of the mandamus power, to prevent the imposition of sanctions. That's one of the bases. At the level of the district court, either to prevent some guy from being hauled off, or the judge has got contempt going against him, which is one of the things,
or the forcing of disclosure of privileged information for which there is no other remedy and can't be corrected by the appeal process once it's in. And the other is that where you aren't given a man disclosure, a la, I can recall a member of this court coming down to the Administration of Justice Committee saying, what are we going to do about Dallas Railway and Terminal and the ex parte lady? How can we handle the problem if we can't get the discovery? And so this court fashioned mandamus in discovery because there wasn't any other way. But that has not been true. The cases, and no later than Walker, there is not any case that has ever ordered severance of causes of action in which there are economic interests relative to all the causes of action and tied together and related to the same basic incident. I'd like to go back to square one. First, next time I'm going to announce that I'm from Alpine, Texas, so I won't wear this court out to be the last to argue either. But I want to answer something you raised, Judge Kilgarland. I think it's probably only fair to say that the severance request does include a Schaefer also in as respects this so-called tort of overreach with the lady. And the reason is, and let me very briefly say the way we vision what transpired. The accident occurred in October of 78, and not long thereafter, according to our allegations, this widow employed Ronnie Crist, known to, I guess, all the members of the court, and certainly take judicial knowledge of his abilities. And he, in turn, according to our allegations, disemployed himself and sent the file back to her in early January after consultations and being advised by members of United that there wasn't any chance to prevail on a third-party claim. And that within the next 6 weeks, contrary, the same company and its in-house lawyer, by arrangement with the drilling company, came to visit her and said, we are going to pursue Amerada Hess and Central Power and Light and would like to know, would you like to join with us in the prosecution of that claim? Not area mention of the potential claim against Schaefer, and this court, if it can't take judicial knowledge, can certainly know as a fact that had that sting operation after Ronnie withdrew on those representations been effective, this lady would never have had her claim against the employer for what is clearly gross negligence. This gross negligence claim was filed before Burke Royalty. It was that gross. That is gross. The carrying it a step further, the same in-house lawyer filed the answer on behalf of Schaefer and filed the intervention petition for the money back. Now, it doesn't take any real, a layman can understand this, this doesn't take instructions from a judge, that the effect of what was being done was to control the third-party action. And anybody that's been in the sore back business knows how keen that is for the insurance company and for the employer. Both. That is the fraud and the overreach about which we speak. Now, unlike what Mr. McKinley tells the court, we speak that but for the overlay of the Compensation Act itself, this widow and her husband, with whom she was, of course, privy, would have had an election to seek the actual damages resulting from his death if she could prove neglect and wrongdoing. Our little final trap didn't work. that you got to another good lawyer and he avoided it. That you can't now come back and say we want to use the same limitations that arise solely from our policy, from the alleged breach of our fiduciary duties, and say we can still insist upon the limitations that are due and owing under our policy of insurance, which incidentally, this court can't even know as it sits here today what type of policy. It's not even before you. And I should add, this is not a complaint as in Kirby or as in Massey, which is before you on a grant, but not haven't been submitted yet, by the employer. This is a case by the insurance company itself. What we say is that there was and is, by all the decisions, an adequate remedy at law. They have not exhausted remedies they have, which should always, we at least submit, precede any attempt to use the broad discretion you've granted under 41 with respect to severance or joinder and consolidation of cases. The court really early announced that in Industrial Accident versus Lynn, and Chief Justice Holt addressed himself to it. Are we going to just intercede right in the middle of all administrative remedies and say, we're just going to grab this case out and tell you, Judge, what you're going to do with it? How you're going to sever it? How you're going to handle it? Not let us determine incipiently, are you going to open another new remedy for you court, this court to be visited regularly with? Will they review this discretion on severance, separate trial? I thought that was the main reason why you invested that broad discretion. Moving to the, I guess, a more esoteric question, I'm not sure, it's always dangerous to talk about the cases you lost and feel bitter about, and that's true about Kirby Petroleum versus Jones, and I couldn't get the attention of this august tribunal, and I felt real aggrieved, and still do. I have a sort of an elephantine nature, but there are a lot of things about that decision that we think distinguish it. In the first place, the appeal was by the employer. And the second thing about it, it was in the context of an appeal process. And the third thing about it, the court did in fact find that the injection of insurance did produce an improper result as to one of the awards for one of the beneficiaries, one of the statutory beneficiaries. We thought that was substantive error and so urged, but without able to sustain the relief or obtain the attention of the court at that time. But certainly, if anything is clear since Kirby and Jones, it is not a case that stands for this court policing the discretionary powers that you have expressly granted to the trial court, intercessory before the exhaustion of remedies. Reaching down there almost with a bullwhip and saying, wait a minute, stop. Nor is it authority for the proposition that the injection or introduction of a fact of insurance is harmful per se. Since the decision in Dennis versus Hulsey, this court has had numerous occasions to suggest that it is not presumptively harmful. And in fact, the cases in which you have upheld it or affirmed it or approved it have indicated it is not a bugaboo properly controlled. Now, I would be less than candid with this court if I did not say whether this case is tried in the context of separated or together Schaefer and the carrier, in that they're really one and the same. I mean, that there isn't prejudice involved, rightful prejudice, in what they undertook to do. That wouldn't be right for me to say that. But that's going to float around with them wherever they go, according to our view. And there's a difference between wrongful prejudice and prejudice you're entitled to have. Now, in relation to the problem, we have, let me say, we're not trying to borrow the problems in Massey before it's submitted to you. Massey also is an appeal by the employer. We have, and would be, if it's of interest to the court, briefed extensively throughout the country the cases having to do with the so-called new tort of the bad faith insurance carrier, and would be glad to file it and give it whatever time they care to reply to it. This is a rapidly developing area. It may be something the court has an interest in. We think it clearly and fully would support the major premise that we take here today. The case that we have found, however, within our own jurisprudence, that comes closest to measure the conduct which we believe to be here today is the Fifth Circuit case, which we feel passing service to, sometimes we don't. If it's our way, we think it's all right. But it's Hatfield versus Anthony Products, and it's cited in both our briefing efforts, and in which an employer sought to make representations as to the nature of his employee status, and sort of city slicked both the employees, other employees, and the carrier too, with respect to premiums, although in fact they were clearly employees. And that conduct alone was held to visit back upon the employer and, of course, his insurance carrier, the election about which we speak, that kind of conduct.
What was the recent case decided by the 14th Court said it was improper to allow a Deceptive Trade Practice Act case in conjunction with a workers' comp case? Are you familiar
with that? I'm not familiar with that, Judge Kiergarten. The other case, the court may remember, in which the estoppel type theory, in which there are a lot of areas in which you've done bad faith areas of the insurance company already, and there's Stowers type things, and Hernandez and Balcom, but is employers Ree versus Tilly, where unbeknownst to an assured, a lawyer for the carrier that has appointed theoretically to work for the assured, was taking statements from the assured which provided a defense under the policy, and this court held as a matter of law they could not assert that exclusion and defense by reason of that failure to disclose. We say these measure the type of the tort you have before you. And that being true, whether it's of the new tort, the Massey kind of tort that you will be considering, or what we believe, that arises out of the actual damages that this woman and her husband would have sustained but for the overlay of the Compensation Act itself, that there are common questions of fact and law in the proceeding as to both the carrier and as to in the gross negligence context. And even if you're talking about just a new tort that just they're bad actors, because the gross negligence case cannot be tried without proof of the actual damages, the manner in which the accident happened, the amount of actual damages, because under your Fort Worth and Russell versus Russell, you established many, many years ago, 1934, that before you can get your exemplary damages in a gross negligence employee case, you must establish the neglect and the actual damages in the gross negligence case for proportionate assessment reasons. That's a clear holding. Even though if the carrier has been otherwise a nice person, you don't get your actual damages. You only get the limits of the act. But the court may or may not recall, we've cited Russell again, But that is a common question that is, has to be tried in every gross negligent employee case. The same facts are applicable in both. There is common question. And for these reasons, we say to the court that we think that the trial court not only did not abuse his discretion, but considering judicial economy, that it is a matter this the court should not issue its writ and should not intercede in the process. We would also say we would be pleased to file this brief and say the supplemental brief that deals purely with a so-called new tort if the court has an interest in whatever time they in learning of that.
Counsel, are you asking to file a legal brief?
Judge, it's just my feeling that the court has, it is pretty exhaustive treatment of those, of all those cases all over the country. You may have an interest for our case because I don't know how much in depth in a mandamus case you care to go into the court. I know you have granted the writ to be heard, I think, on the 26th or 2 weeks hence in Massey, where you'll be considering the nature of the so-called tort. And, I don't want to be presuming on their business.
Justices, I'd like to reply to some of the points made by the respondents in their brief and in their last argument, which I didn't file a response to in writing because I only got this brief a while ago. But it doesn't raise new points, although it states some things differently. And I think it's important that I bring to the court's attention some of the inapplicable citations which have been given by opposing counsel. One of those is the Pattison versus Highway Insurance Underwriters case, which is offered by respondents as an indication that it is possible to place insurance in a lawsuit without injecting any harm into one side's position. The cause is quoted on page 16 of the reply brief of respondents for that purpose. I would say to the court that in looking at the discussion on page 16, you'll see that the two causes of action which the court is considering, the issue of severance in connection with, it's obvious that one of them is a cause of action for fraud and the other is a cause of action for false representations. In each case, the insurance company is necessarily involved. I don't think that case stands as authority for the proposition it's meant to argue. I would also like to deal with some of the arguments Mr. Conger has just brought up, which don't raise any new points, but also restate them in a way that requires response. I think the Womack versus Berry case, which Mr. Conger attempted to distinguish on the ground that it severed issues, actually did say, as he says it did. But the important part of that case is not whether issues or causes or parties were being severed. The important part of the case is the holding of this court that you will issue mandamus to correct an abuse of discretion by a trial judge. It doesn't turn on the circumstances. It's a general rule that applies to severance of one type as opposed to severance of another type and to non-severance situations. And in connection with that, in case I haven't adequately emphasized it to the court, I would like to discuss the circumstances more thoroughly in which this court has said to a judge in a mandamus proceeding, you will do this because you abused your discretion, in which this court has not, as Mr. Conzer suggests, waited until a trial has been finished to determine whether or not harmless error was injected into the record by insurance
counsel,
being
counsel, let me ask you this. Let's suppose in this case that the pleadings had alleged what was obviously hearsay evidence, obviously inadmissible on trial. And then let us say that you filed an exception to that, and that that exception would go to the very cause of action, because all of the cause of action, as alleged, depended upon hearsay, which is incompetent. And the trial court refused to sustain your exception. And then you'd have to go on and try the case, and then you could urge that on appeal. What is disturbing me is if we are going to start assuming jurisdiction over severance procedures, then will we also go into special exceptions and pleas and abatement and all other procedural matters?
Well, Chief Justice, I'd respond first that I'm not asking you to start, because it's our position that the court has already started. In Womack versus Berry back in, I think, 1956, you've already done it. So it's not
and
as
we
though
did, and we did in discovery.
Right, it's not as though it's new. And I don't
well,
know.
Well, it's new in severance, and it's new in justice. But go ahead.
Pardon me, Your Honor. Womack versus Berry was a severance case. And it's our position that it is difficult for this court to draw the line, but I'm not going to say what types of discovery rulings should be subject to that abuse of discretion test. That's a judgment that this court will have to make. I'll only say that a ruling such as the one this court has before it not only should be subject to the abuse of discretion test on the grounds that I've already discussed, but has the force of this court's prior rulings behind it, because this court has already ruled that it will issue mandamus and has done so to correct an abuse of discretion in connection with severance. In the landmark case of Allen v. Humphreys in 1977, we had a situation which was far less critical than the one we face today. We had plaintiffs who were saying, Safeway, you have cut polyvinyl chloride wrapping with hot cutting devices, and you've put pollutants into the air, and you've caused this woman's medical problems. There was a question whether or not the evidence would even be admissible, but this court ruled that because the evidence, which the trial court wouldn't order the defense to produce, might lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, this court would order mandamus, and it did. Now, that case is so much less critical than the circumstances we face here that they can hardly be compared. But that is an example of the clearly erroneous ruling of a trial judge, which constitutes an abuse of discretion, being overturned by this court in a mandamus proceeding. Now, if this court will do that in order to get production of documents which might lead to discovery of municipal evidence, think how much more important it is.
The problem is that historically, following that case you cited, the court had over 100 mandamuses filed requesting discovery. The court was in the trial business.
This court has, in fact, seen a lot of mandamuses, and I'm aware
Walker
of
Walker was written subsequent to that, I believe, was it not?
Which one?
Walker. Pat Walker?
Yes, it was, Your Honor, and that case I don't think stands for as broad a proposition as Mr. Cronzer would have it. Even if it does, though, I think the test of whether or not there's an adequate alternative remedy still indicates that we should be held subject to the abuse of discretion test in this case for the reasons I've already discussed. I don't see how the court could possibly sort out the evidence in a case like this and make a determination under the Reese versus State Farm holding that this stack of evidence probably caused the verdict as opposed to this equally high stack of evidence. I think that would really put the court in an impossible position as far as determining whether or not at a certain point, which maybe this court hasn't faced yet, it is necessary to say that the court is equipped to function as a second fact finder. That you've got to do it right at the start. And if the judge sees a case such as this, which presents the same circumstances as the St. Paul Fire Insurance case, which you asked Mr. Cronzer about, which I already mentioned, which the 14th Court has already said should have been severed, which case I understand is up before this court, then I think it's important to say trial judges under these kind of circumstances.
Well, the problem is that case proves right there that you can review it by appeal, isn't it? Isn't that the exact point?
Your Honor, the case shows that the 14th Court overruled it and found, because the litigant chose to pursue the appeal remedy, that the litigant was ultimately right and on the record found it. Now, in our case, we haven't chosen to pursue that remedy. We haven't chosen to go to trial with this ticking time bomb and guess whether it's going to blow us up, and if it does, whether this court is going to pick up the pieces and say, well, you were right after all and you get another trial. We've relied on the record of decisions by this court over the last two decades indicating that you will correct abuses of discretion. And I would say that this case goes even farther than that. I'd say in line with Kirby and the other holdings that I've cited, this case is one in which no discretion is exercised. I cannot think of a reason for trying these two causes of action together. Mr. Kronzer suggested one. He said, I've never seen a case where economic interests were bound together as he thinks they are in this case, and the court ordered a severance. Well, I can't offer one either. Simply because there are almost no mandamus cases to look at, and they just don't happen to involve that situation. I would suggest this, though. There is no common economic interest other than the fact that United General wrote an insurance policy for one of the defendants, and based on that, the respondents have chosen to make United General a defendant. If that is enough, then every bright and aggressive plaintiff's lawyer who sees a situation in which there's a third-party claim and the insurance company did something that might be wrong is going to sue the insurance company. And talk about litigation, this court is going to have a flood of cases in which plaintiff's lawyers have combined their lawsuits and the jury hears all about insurance and it's possible to pick up the pieces and the jury gets very mad and it awards high damage verdicts against the insurance company and the defendant.
Counsel, if we get those cases, we will go to the regular course of appeal, won't we, have the original proceedings?
You will, Your Honor, and I will suggest that you'll get them by virtue of, dare I say it, having made a mistake if you overrule our mandamus petition
in
this case.
When we reverse that case, though, then they will know that they can't do that. I mean, if an error is being committed, we're not inviting all of this type of litigation if it's wrong, because we'll take care of it on appeal and say so.
Your Honor, under those circumstances, you'll be putting yourself in the position of being a second fact finder, and you'll be already committed to the harmless error test. You'll be committed to looking at the entire record and reconstructing it and trying to make a judgment, well, as opposed to doing what you've already done in previous decades and looked at an abuse of discretion.
What you're saying to me is that there are 331 district judges out here, and if they make certain mistakes, that we ought to save our own work by attending to it and by an interim extraordinary proceeding so that we wouldn't have to go to the trouble to appeal it. And that's just not the way you can run a judicial system.
Well, Your Honor, as I understand it, you've already done that.
Yes, I'm afraid too much so.
You've done it in this case by considering this petition along with dozens of others this year, or last year, hundreds maybe, and you sorted out this case as one that deserved consideration, and that's the same kind of process you can use in upcoming years. The non-meritorious ones you can just toss out.
In 1965, there were 15 mandamuses filed annually in this court, and we granted maybe one or two of them. In 1981, there were more than 150 mandamuses, a thousand-fold increase, and we granted, I think, four of them.
Your Honor, I'm aware of the record, and you put me in a difficult position because I can't argue with this court about its judicial burden, and I can't even tell you what it is.
Are you suggesting that in case where the plaintiff, automobile accident case where the plaintiff pleads gross negligent entrustment, which is usually done for the purpose of being able to show the previous driving record of the defendant, that we ought to grant a writ of mandamus on a special exception hearing?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. You can plead gross negligent entrustment as part of a cause of action against one employer, and that doesn't involve an insurance company. I'm afraid that at some point this court does have to act, as Mr. Kronzer says, policemen, also judges, and look over the shoulders of district court judges and in some cases tell them they made a mistake. And this court has done that before, and I'm asking this court to do that again. We're asking for the abuse of discretion test to be applied, as this court has applied it in at least a dozen cases dating back to 1956, dating back to Barker versus Dunham. And applying it again in this case doesn't suggest to me that there's going to be a flood of litigation. Rather, it suggests to me that the message will go out to trial judges. You can't do that. It'll go out to trial lawyers, especially the plaintiff's bar, saying it's just not going to work anymore, so don't even waste your time. I would dare suggest that a ruling from the court, as we ask in this case, will save workload. And I think that the reason this court has heard mandamus cases in the past is not just because they're meritorious, because maybe a lot of them are, but because the court has picked out areas where people, judges, have been making mistakes and has said, we've just got to clear up that area. They're making a lot of mistakes there, and it's wrong, and we're going to issue a decision that will tell them why it's wrong. And we already see one case from the 14th Court of District before this court, and now we see this case, and there's no limit to the number of other cases. And a ruling from this court right now, as the relator asks, I think will go a long way toward correcting the impression that trial courts may now have, at least some trial courts, that it's permissible to join this new tort with a regular third-party liability action. In summation, I'd like to reemphasize to the court, as the record shows, that we have a totally different time frame in this case. We have an accident producing a death. We have much, much later representations alleged which may or may not give rise to a cause of action. We have totally different persons involved in the death case, which does not even involve the insurance company. We have an almost totally different set of persons involved in the insurance misrepresentation case. The only two links in this entire case are the fact that representatives of the plaintiff's employer, or the decedent's employer, Schaefer Well Service, may have been involved in both the insurance fraud cause of action and the wrongful death cause of action, and the fact that there was an insurance policy issued by United General for the decedent's employer. And I don't think that kind of tenuous economic connection has ever been the kind of evidence that this court has considered sufficient to join two causes of action. And I would go further and suggest that it's the kind of tenuous connection that should have told Judge Caldwell that he just couldn't rule the way he did, and that under the circumstances, the case has to be settled.
Thank you, Kelsey. Because it's submitted on